I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection, and it's spring, well, at least officially. Maybe where you are, the sun is shining and the flowers are in bloom. Here in Boston, there are still grey lumps of snow on the ground, and the prediction is for freezing rain. So, to mark the start of spring, we did what a lot of Bostonians do. We got ourselves to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. This is a Venetian-style palazzo filled to the gills with art collected by the eccentric and energetic Mrs. Gardner. The museum is built around a four-story covered courtyard where flowers bloom in profusion every day of the year. We met Dan Kozak, who's been the Gardner's gardener for 30 years, to find out what's blooming now.
We have colomandin orange trees, blue cineraria, white azaleas, yellow eureops, and yellow cytisus trees.
Which means nothing, probably, unless you are a gardener. I mean, what we've got here is small little purple plants. I gather they went in yesterday.
Yes, they've gone in the last week or so.
Why purple flowers for spring? I would have thought daffodils, tulips.
Well, within the next couple of weeks, we will have daffodils and tulips, but the blue cineraria go very well color-wise with the colomandin oranges, and later on in the season, we'll have clivia and orange nasturtiums.
And when you're designing your garden for the season in this lovely Venetian courtyard, are you thinking about the sort of mood you're creating for visitors to the museum, saying, here it is, it's spring, it's rebirth?
I'm always thinking about the mood. One of my favorite things to do is to stand at the beginning of the courtyard and watch the public's reaction as they come in, and it's still cold outdoors, and we come into the courtyard, and there's all sorts of color, and that's the mood that I try to set.
And Dan Kozak does set the mood at the Gardner Museum in Boston, and he's set the mood for a question to Connection listeners. How important are the flowers that bloom in the spring for you? Is there one particular flower you ache to see again each spring? And what is it about flowers, after all, that stirs the human soul? Make the Spring Flowers Connection at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also see the garden at The Gardener and join our conversation online at theconnection.org. Joining me in the studio is Tom Fisher, Executive Editor of Horticulture Magazine here in Boston. And we're joined by phone from Portland, Oregon, by Ketzel Levine, a longtime journalist correspondent for National Public Radio, who threw over the coverage of art and sports and hard news to become, as she puts it, the doyen of dirt. You can find Ketzel Levine's Talking Plants at npr.org. And she's written a book called Plant This. Welcome to you both. Can I start with you, Tom Fisher? Spring, special time for gardeners, certainly, but is it just because you want to get out there, get your fingers dirty again, or is there something much more than that?
Well, that's certainly part of it, Judy. I think by this time of the year, everyone is so sensory-deprived and so sick of the big piles of dirty snow that you're just craving color and life of some kind. But I think another part of it is that we're part of this big cycle of nature, whether we're aware of it or not. I mean, after all, even though we don't like to think of it, flowers are really the sexual parts of plants. And when everyone's juices get flowing in the spring, I mean, it just runs all throughout the both the animal and the plant kingdom. We're part of it. And so I think we respond to this gaudy display of color and life and reawakening energy.
But which comes first? I mean, is it the flowers that make us feel spring-like? Or is it just that the flowers remind us that it's spring, you think, phew, winter's over?
Well, the urge is there. I think we certainly anticipate the appearance of the first flowers, whether they're snowdrops or daffodils or crocuses or whatnot. I think a lot of gardeners anticipate that urge by starting their seeds early and looking at nursery catalogs and just gearing up for the big flood of color that's just a few weeks down the road.
Well, Ketzel Levine, let's bring you in here. I was bit stunned when I went to the Gardner Center that you know, there were sort of purples and whites. They didn't seem to say spring to me. Are there trends in flowers? Are there certain colors that are associated with certain seasons?
Oh, sure. I think that people think of probably my two most hated colors next to each other, pink and yellow. That's what spring often looks like to me. You get your daffodils and your forsythia next to, well, here anyway, we've got the magnolias and the early rhododendron. And it's, as Tom says, it is a gaudy display. Tom, I love your idea of the juices flowing. You know, I've been sort of manic the last couple of weeks. I've noticed that I have to take a lot more notes to remember what's flying through my head, and I realize, oh, I know what the problem is. It's spring.
Well, let me tell you, Ketzel, this is The Connection, in case you've forgotten. And the number to ring is 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, if you'd like to join the conversation. With me in the, here in the studio is Tom Fisher, executive editor of Horticulture Magazine. Tom, we've heard people say that it's sort of a spiritual experience going into the garden. Would you go that far?
Oh, boy. I'm not what you'd call, I think, a spiritual gardener. I love the color. I love the life and the energy of it. And just watching things grow and tending them, that's enough for me. I know the spiritual aspect of gardening is something that a lot of people are interested in these days. But I haven't ventured into that too deeply.
Ketzel was talking about pink and yellow being the colors of spring. Is that true? If you're trying to create the mood of spring, would you go for pink and yellow?
Well, I'm with Ketzel. That's a color combination I really can't stand. And here in Boston, in almost every yard, you see a rhododendron called PJM, which is a screaming magenta. And often as not, it's planted next to a bright yellow forsythia, and usually against a red brick wall. And there can't be a more hideous combination of colors than that pink, that yellow, and that red.
Of course not if you're a pollinating beast, however. Yeah. You know, it's a pretty gorgeous combo.
Oh, yeah. If you're bee with your ultraviolet vision, it looks completely different to you.
Can we explore the sexual question with Ketzel? Ketzel, are they sexual symbols?
I can't wait to hear what the question is.
are plants, in your view, sexual symbols, as Tom was saying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have to come back over and over again to the idea that flowers have evolved to look the way they look in order to entrap, ensnare, and entice that which will pollinate them and reproduce the species. So, you know, this whole idea of gardening, you know, always having been the purvey of polite ladies at tea with their little white gloves and bonnets is really very silly, because it never escaped the notice of these lovely ladies that this was all about sex anyway.
I was wondering if there were fashions in flowers, and certain flowers that are certain symbols. I mean, the rose seems to sustain. The rose, you know, if he brings you a bunch of roses, you're going to forgive him anything.
But, and certainly the sexiest of flowers.
Certainly the sexiest of flowers, but carnations, as far as I'm concerned, always seem to say funeral.
Carnations and gladiolas.
And gladiolas. But lilies have come in and out of fashion, haven't they? I mean, there was hardly a PR office in the world 3 or 4 years ago that wasn't just cluttered with lilies. Now they seem a bit passé. Is that fair?
Well, the good thing about lilies is the wonderful scent that a lot of them have, especially the oriental hybrids and the trumpet hybrids. And especially in recent years, some wonderful new colors have appeared. I don't know. I think lilies are a pretty permanent feature on the gardening scene. The problem for us here in New England is that a disgusting new pest has appeared called the lily beetle. Mm. Which is actually first appeared in Watertown, Massachusetts, has been spreading outward ever since. And these foul little red insects and their larvae will skeletonize a lily plant if you turn your back on them for more than a day or two. Fortunately, they can be controlled. I mean, simple insecticidal soap will take care of them, but you have to be very vigilant. And I, for one, refuse to give up my lilies to these disgusting little bugs.
Now, as you'd have heard in the opening, that there were lilies in the Gardener Center. And I said that I found that display there not quite what I was expecting for spring. And I've just thought the reason is that it was sort of orange and purple and white. And, of course, in London, we've been through the crocus season. That's pre-spring. I mean, is this what we're thinking in springtime, that there is a certain sequence, a certain expectation?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess, are you saying that you saw lilies at the garden center? Is that what you were just saying there, Judy?
Yes, garden museum.
Well, of course, it would be a little bit disturbing because they are out of season. It's way too early for them. And but the garden museum is not a, you know, an outside natural garden, so they are forcing plants for display. I'd like to just mention something other than flowers for a second, though. I think what really, you'd said in your introduction something that captivated me, which was the idea that the Japanese take a day off when the cherry trees blossom.
Indeed.
I was thinking we should have National Bud Break Day.
What a wonderful idea.
Because it's the buds, it's the swelling of the buds that really gets my juice going.
What is the moment here in Boston, Tom Fisher, when you would say, ah, yes, this is the moment we're waiting for? Because we're drawing contrast. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get calls from people where flowers are in full bloom and spring has arrived. But, I mean, you look outside in Boston, and, you know, inside that courtyard, it was lovely, full bloom. You walked out, it was cold, and it was just bleak.
It's still pretty grim. But the moment when you really know spring is here in Boston is when all the magnolias start to bloom. More than a lot of other cities I'm familiar with, Boston has wonderful magnolias planted everywhere, in the public garden along Commonwealth Avenue, at the Arnold Arboretum, and those start blooming in April, and it seems that they all come into bloom just about at once. And when you hit a sunny blue day and all those magnolias are blooming, it just gets right to you, and you know spring is here.
Well, let's hear from Mrs. Smith now, calling from Derry, New Hampshire. Mrs. Smith, I bet this spring hasn't arrived there, has it?
No, it hasn't. It's about, 4 feet of snow in my backyard.
Oh.
And I've been forcing my forsythia here for weeks now as a touch of spring. I go out and I pick the twigs and I put them in a jar of water and I enjoy them progressively as I get through the snow to pick the twigs. So that's my touch of spring. But growing up in Cambridge...
In England?
In England, yes. Spring started with the aconites and the snowdrops on the backs of the colleges, and then the crocuses and the violets in March and the daffodils in April. But I love spring.
You forgot the bluebells in May.
Oh, the bluebells in May. And the May trees. I love the May trees. So we don't have a spring up here in New Hampshire. It jumps straight from winter into summer. One day it's 45, the next day it's 85. It's a very depressing thing.
Don't you at least have the mud season in between?
It depends. I mean, say we haven't had much melting. This week was about the best one. My mailbox has appeared from underneath 3 feet of snow.
I can't see mailboxes being a precursor of spring. Mrs. Smith, thank you very much for your call. Ketzel, tell us what's going on in your part of the world.
Well, I'm just guilt-ridden. What can I tell you? I was making a little list off the top of my head of stuff that I saw blooming this morning. And, you know, you start with the forsythia and the magnolia and the cherries and the primulas and the mahonias and the euphorbias and the camellias and the edgeworthias. I mean, this place really never stops blooming. You can pretty much find something happening in the Portland, Oregon area 12 months of the year. But, hey, I won't rub it in.
You just
rubbed
it in very effectively. Yeah, Tom Fisher, I mean, how do flowers capture the imagination when you go from stark winter to the summer blossoms?
It starts out gradually, and we have had something here, Ketzel. We have had our witch hazels for the last few weeks, and those are the things that start out the gardening year for us. I just planted a little grove of them at my garden at home with six different varieties. Mm. The most common ones are yellow, but I planted also some ones with coppery orange flowers and deep reds. And so when they're all going and the sun starts shining through the petals, that's the beginning of our gardening year.
We're blooming today on The Connection, talking blossoms and what they say to us and about us. The number to ring is 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, the USDA is going forward with plans to kill more than 350 sheep in...
The Bloom in the Spring Connection. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can see the garden at the Gardner Museum and join the conversation online at theconnection.org. Here in the studio with me is Tom Fisher, executive editor of Horticulture Magazine. And by phone from Portland, Oregon, is Ketzel Levine, NPR's doyen of dirt. And joining us now from Silver City, New Mexico, is Sharman Apt Russell, who's just published a book on our subject. It's called Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. Sharman Apt Russell, I'm afraid we haven't got you just yet. So let's hear from Ketzel Levine. Ketzel, do you think flowers have a secret life?
Oh, a secret life of flowers. I suppose they do. I think that, you know, plants have a secret life. And I think that gardeners, we talked earlier about the spiritual connection to gardening. Like Tom, my experience isn't quite so spiritual, but I can't deny that when I'm out among plants and among flowers, that something else entirely is going on there.
Well, I don't think that Tom was actually saying that it was wholly spiritual. Tom, what I was exploring was, is gardening the physical enjoyment, or is there something more? If it's communing with nature, why garden? Why not just go for a walk?
That's a good question. I think one of the reasons gardening is so satisfying is that there are many different ways of deriving satisfaction from it. There is the sheer physical part of it, working in the dirt, working with plants, the physical contact with plants and the soil. But there's also a very much an intellectual side of gardening. Gardening has a wonderful and rich history. I mean, plants have come down to us that have been cultivated and hybridized for ages. Very often, gardeners develop passions for particular kinds of plants. And when that happens, you start doing all sorts of research. You want to find out everything you can about that group of plants. You want to know everything about it. You want to grow every single variety that you can lay your hands on. And it just becomes this consuming obsession. Obsession, I think, is a trait that most gardeners share. You just get passionately interested in something.
So what's your obsession?
Oh, I've got lots of them.
Oh, boy, Judy, I don't know what you've just stepped into.
Oh, boy.
What I want to know is, you know, I think plants are really ornery things. So they have so many demands, and, you know, one wants water and another one doesn't want water. I mean, I'll confess, all I've got is a few houseplants, and they're all pretty much dead.
You know, I was going to say, it sounds like you grow houseplants, because...
No, I don't grow them. I kill them.
Houseplants are ornery, but I think that Tom would agree that it takes very little when you pick the right plant for the right place to grow gardens outside. Very little. I mean, there's a lot of hoopla about the best way and how to and all of this nonsense, but really, you know, right plant, right place, you've got it. It's brainless.
I'm always astonished at what a will to live most plants have. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you're picking something that has extremely exacting cultural requirements. Even, you know, small seedlings, small divisions of plants, these things want to live. They want to put out roots and get in the ground and grow.
Well, joining us now from Silver City, I'm pleased to say, Silver City in New Mexico, is Sharman Apt Russell, author of Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers. So, Sharman, tell me about the secret life of flowers.
Well, it's a secret. No, I really kind of wrote it to discover that secret life. And, you know... It's a marvel, you know, and it involves a lot of other things like bees and ants and cockroaches and mammals and other flowers. And
what were you actually exploring here? You say anatomy of a rose. I mean, elaborate on that.
Okay, I think I was interested in seeing things from a flower's perspective. You know, as humans, we kind of name flowers and we grow flowers. And I was interested in seeing what does a honeybee see when it sees a flower, and how do flowers interact with each other. And the anatomy part was kind of a sense of what is the science behind flowers, and what is the non-human perspective behind flowers.
But when you say interact with each other, what do you mean by that?
Well, they compete.
They do?
Yeah, they do. They have to compete for resources, of course. There are some flowers that... parasitize other flowers or flowering plants. They, you know, flowers will grow taller if they sense they're being shaded by other flowers. They, you know, flowers can see, you know, and with the little quotes around that, they see different wavelengths. They see when they're being shaded. They can sniff things. They sniff compounds in the air, or rather compounds land, and they can, you know, respond when they sense certain volatiles. They really have this kind of extraordinary life all on their own that has nothing to do with us at all.
But tell me, when you're getting into the secret life of plants, are you talking about cultivated ones, or are you talking about wild ones? Because when you're talking cultivated ones, aren't people interfering with nature? Haven't we done something to these plants we should not?
Well, we've done things. We've certainly, bred flowers to do certain things, usually to look larger and to look brighter and to be hardier. And, those are good things. That's part of our relationship with flowers. I deal with a lot of wildflowers in the book, but I also talk about some domesticated varieties. But even our wild flowers, even our domesticated flowers are flowers, and they're coming out of the same biological, imperatives that the wild flowers are too.
Tell me what sort of spring you're getting down there in New Mexico now.
Oh, it's so wonderful. You know how in winter sometimes you start without even knowing it, feeling a little disenchanted with your life, a little, less in love with your life. I know I was. And then really just this last week, on this kind of subliminal, unconscious level, things seem more wonderful and you fall in love again with who you are and with the world around you. Suddenly the willows and the cottonwoods are getting that kind of nimbus that surrounds them when their catkins come out, and the daffodils and the iris certainly are coming out, and the fruits are flowering, the plums and the peaches, and it's just all beginning. You get that kind of glitter in the air of something starting.
Now you're making gourmands salivate as well as gardeners, Shaman.
Well, it's something that is very rich and wonderful, and I think that's why people love flowers. They speak to us on so many different levels.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. If you'd like to talk flowers, Teresa Wood. Teresa, hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. What would you like to tell us?
Oh, I just wanted to mention my very favorite first flower is the yellow lady slipper that grows in my yard. My absolute favorite.
It's quite rare, isn't it?
Yes, and I bought it without endangering it, like you're supposed to. It is the most beautiful, sexy flower there is.
Well, I think the two giggling gardeners agreed there. Let's hear from Teresa. Thanks very much for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Gerald from Louisville, Kentucky. Gerald.
Yes, hello. Thanks for continuing the show in Louisville here. They've been voting on whether we should keep listening to you all, and I think, as public radio property, it's good that you're still on the air.
Well, thank you for that. What would you like to say about flowers?
Well, I recently had a family trip down, a necessary trip to Florida and back, and it was just wonderful to go through Atlanta and see all the red buds in the early stage and later coming out. And then 2 weeks ago, I was down at Mammoth Cave, and we got to see the first trilliums starting to rise out of the ground. And I particularly like wildflowers and trees in the natural setting, and kind of limit my gardening to vegetables and things that seem utilitarian, because the natural landscapes, to me, with the wildflowers and trees, are so wonderful this time of the year.
Gerald, thanks for that. I'd like to pick up that point as well with my two gardeners, Tom Fisher and Ketzer Levine. Tom Fisher, we were discussing the difference between, you said it was a very good question, why don't you just go walk in the countryside? I mean, it's almost as if gardening is man's power over plants.
Well, there probably is an aspect of wanting to control nature in there, but there's also a very strong counter impulse, I think. A lot of people like naturalistic gardenings, wildflower gardening. And the trick there is to create a garden scene that looks as though it could be part of a natural landscape. We've got a wonderful resource here in the Boston area, the Garden in the Woods, which is the headquarters of the New England Wildflower Society. And in May, that place is just a riot of wonderful woodland plants. But in my own garden at home, I've left part of the area to be sort of a wild woodland garden, the part that's sort of shaded by oak trees. And there I've planted ferns and wild phlox and lady slippers and a lot of things that will sort of remind me, at least, of a woodland garden.
But a woodland garden, recreated woodland garden.
Recreated, certainly.
It's sort of like Europe created by Disney.
Well, I think that the impulse is maybe a little closer to something genuine when you're gardening. Certainly, I think to garden that way successfully, you do need to take the requirements of the plants into consideration. You need to make sure the soil is the kind of soil they like, that you're meeting their moisture requirements and that they're basically going to thrive for you and behave the way they would in the wild. If they're happy and thriving, then the scene's going to look as though it belongs there. It won't have that sort of tinge of artificiality to it.
Can I ask both gardeners as well, as we're talking about plans or happenings for spring, if it's driven by what plants will grow then, or if you actually think, now is summer, I want to create this mood in my garden now? Kessel Levine, let's hear from you first.
Well, I'm still thinking about this other issue that you brought up, and that's the idea of, you know, what's contrived, and is a garden essentially a contrivance? And I think the bottom line is yes, of course it is. If our landscapes were left the way they originally were, you know, then you'd have to erase lawn. You'd have to go way back to find out what we ever had here, and God knows, you know, few of us can remember and ever saw a city like that. But I think that what's happening in garden and among gardeners is are two impulses. One is what Com's describing, which is an interest in naturalistic landscaping. And then you've got people like me. I've got a tiny space, a very tiny space. And when you're confronted with something like that, you know, it's all make-believe. I'm in the middle of a city. Of course, you know, what I'm going to do really is only going to suit me. It's not what used to be here at all. And my own impulse, surprisingly enough, has been for a much more formal landscape with less plants than I ever thought I would want to grow, simply because I need the garden to stop the madness of urban living. So it becomes an urban retreat, if you will. And in its own way, it's almost a facsimile of what one hopes to feel when one is away from the city, but trying to find that sense of calm within. It's an interesting challenge.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jeanette is on the line. Jeanette.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment about the spiritual nature of gardening. I feel deeply connected when I'm out in the garden. It's almost like I can feel the life underneath the soil, you know, ready to come forward. And I use the gardening as a healing space when my mother died very suddenly. I was very, very depressed, and my husband used it as an instrument for luring me out of the bed. And it really worked, and I felt, I think what Tom's comment about their sense of wanting to live, you know, the impulse to the will to live that plants have, I think it's incredibly therapeutic, and I can't help but feel connected to the plants and things that grow because of it.
Jeanette, can I ask you where you live? I mean, we were hearing about urban retreats. Is that what you've got, or do you have a wonderful country spread?
Oh, if only I had a country spread. No, I live in the middle of Worcester, Massachusetts, so we have about a quarter of an acre, which is a large-sized lot for Worcester, but you know, I just throw every spring, it's like a sense of rebirth, and I think not only does it affect our, you know, our senses because of the sight, the beauty of the flowers and the color, but also we have aromatherapy going on, and just connecting with another living plant that doesn't need us, I think, is just very healing.
Jeanette, thanks for that. Let's put that to Charmaine Russell, the author of Anatomy of a Rose. Charmaine, a spiritual side of plants for us. Hello, Charmaine Russell?
Yes, hi.
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 We were hearing the idea it's an urban retreat, it's also spiritual for us, plants. Is that what you were seeking, what plants mean to us?
Absolutely. And not only what plants mean to us in the sense of that they're part of that non-human world that we don't dominate and that we can't ever dominate, but also, you know, how our relationship with plants, it's not one of domination. It can't be. They're really stronger and more powerful. The whole natural world is. I think we create relationships and we'll take relationships wherever we can get them. And whether it's with a, you know, a single flower in a window box or whether it's with a, you know, a field of flowers, it's our ability to see that there's a relationship there and to feel that relationship.
Well, I mean, I know there was in the children's book, The Little Prince by Saint-Exupéry,
right,
that the little prince has the relationship with the rose. But that's symbolic of something else, isn't it? It's not sort of a direct relationship with a rose.
No. Well, it can be both, I suppose. I think it might work on both levels. But again, it's that non-human, and I think what is non-human can be equated with what is divine, what is kind of beyond our ego and our concerns. Today, of course, I think we're also just talking about having to really look at can define our human relationship with the natural world in general. And so because we do have such impact and power over the natural world, that there's that symbolic part, too, that kind of humility that we perhaps need to find and to exercise.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John is calling from Poughkeepsie, New York. John.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to talk a little bit about our role as caretakers. I've had Native teachers, Native American Indian teachers, who've talked a great deal at length with me about our role as caretakers, an intrinsic role we play an interplay with the plants and the natural world. And I think this kind of consciousness can be brought into even a small garden in a city. This idea that we do have an intrinsic role. We are the caretakers. We can weed even the forest land that I have. I can act as a pruner of everything from the tiny flowers of the wild strawberries that are often overlooked, perhaps while we're looking at the large wood lilies or some of the other more garish flowers.
But John, I'm always wondering, you know, what makes a flower a flower and what makes a flower a weed?
I think, to be honest, it's to a great degree, it's perception. It's the idea of we travel thousands of miles to see the Grand Canyon, and yet don't lay on our bellies to in our backyards to see the wonders of the wolf spiders and the tiny insects that crawl across the plantain or the other so-called weeds we have in our backyards. It's a matter of perception. It's a matter of choice.
John, thanks very much for that. Quick word from Tom Fisher, caretakers of the land. Tom, is that how you see yourself?
Well, I don't know if I dare to call myself a caretaker. I do try to be careful, though, in my gardening practices. I think we do have a responsibility as gardeners about the plants we go to make sure that they're not aggressive things that are going to spread outside the confines of our gardens and colonize other places where we don't want them.
So you are sort of juggling things and manipulating things and making sure you don't upset the balance of nature too much.
Well, you are, and you do need to be conscious of what you're doing and make sure you don't do something that's going to have a really negative effect on what's outside your garden. Also in the use of the chemicals you use in your garden, whether you use sprays and pesticides and whatnot.
We can get back to that after the break. We're talking flowers this hour. Does getting down and dirty in the garden now spring has sprung make you feel spiritual or just self-righteous? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, part three of a special report on Cape Cod's missile detection system, looking at the role that paved...
Thrown to a passing breeze, but pressed, yes, they're pressed in my book of memories.
I'm Judy Swallow. This is the Spring Flowers Connection. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Flowers and spring have inspired as many poets and artists as there are in a host of golden daffodils. Our guest, Tom Fisher, executive editor of Horticulture Magazine, has brought in an anthology called Heart of the Flower, Poems for the Sensuous Gardener. You've picked a favorite or two to read to us, I think.
I have, Judy. Denise Levertov has a wonderful poem called Earliest Spring, and I don't know many other poets who have observed flowers so well or so closely. And the great thing about this poem is it's told from a child's perspective, a child walking with her mother through the garden and looking at the spring flowers. Earliest spring. Iron scallops border the path, barely above the earth, a purplish starling luster. Earth a different dark, scumbled, bare, between clumps of wintered over stems. Slowly, from French windows open to first mild, pale, after winter morning, we inch forward, looking, pausing, examining each plant. It's boring. The dry stalks are tall as I, up to her thigh, but then, "Oh, look, a snowdrop," she cries, satisfied. And I see thin, sharp green darning needles stitched through the sticky gleam of dirt, belled with white. "And another, and here, look, and here, a white carillon." Then she stoops to show me precise, bright green check marks, vivid on inner petals, each outer petal filing down to a point. And more, crocuses, yes, here they are. And these point upward, closed tight as eyelids waiting a surprise, egg yolk gold or mauve. And she brings my gaze to filigree veins of violet traced upon white that make the mauve seem. This is the earliest spring of my life. Last year I was a baby, and what I saw then is forgotten. Now I'm a child. Now I'm not bored at moving step by step, slow, down the path. Each pause brings us to bells or flames.
Wonderful evocation of spring there.
That was beautiful, Tom.
That's Ketzel Levine you heard just intervene there. Ketzel Levine, NPR's host of Talking Plants. Connection listeners, what's your favorite spring flower poem? They don't all have to be happy poems, of course. Think of T.S. Eliot. April is the cruelest month because it stirs our dull roots. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. But I'd like to bring Sharmanapt Russell in here, the author of Anatomy of a Rose. Sharman, I was wondering, particularly from Tom's reading of that poem there, if the wonderful thing about plants is they're ephemeral.
Yes. That's right. That's right. They are renewing. They come again, and you'll know them again, but they're not something you can take for granted. And they're brief, and I think they're more powerful in their briefness.
In that case, are they a bit like nature's Christmas or something? They come round and it's sort of, we log, you know, sort of note that another year has gone by.
They've got that rhythm. And again, there's something that you know will come back. I mean, they're part of our lives, but they come and go. You know, I think the thing about flowers that we sometimes forget is that they're about sex, too. And we respond to them in kind of undercurrents and powerful ways about that sense of birth and renewal and survival, because they're the sexual organ of a plant, and I think they're partly so compelling to us because they reach us on that level too.
Do you know you're the third person on this program to say it? The other two being my two gardener guests. I think all gardeners must be sexually obsessed.
Oh, anyway. Yeah, we have secret meetings where we talk about these things.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK if you'd like to join in. Lorraine is calling from Watertown, New York. Lorraine.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have an interesting story. I'll try to make it brief. I went to a white elephant sale at church, and it was at the end of the sale, and there was this pathetic-looking little plant, and it had four little very dark reddish or brownish, really, leaves, and it said it was an ivy geranium. So I brought it home, and I started to take care of it, and I had it for about a year and a half. I lost my husband in September. By the time September came, I had hanging in my north dining room window the most beautiful, beautiful red leaved plant, or the very pointy leaves, jaggedy, and with deep green veins. And it hung there in the window, and it was just an inspiration to me, because I thought I had lost the plant. I knew I felt I'd lost my husband. And it has died over the winter, and it's coming back. I've been nurturing it and watering it and put it in the light, not too much.
But
for me, that's been a spiritual experience. And, you know, it gives you, it's a challenge. It's spiritual. It gives you something to do after you've raised your children.
Well, indeed, I was going to ask you, is it like nurturing? It's a form of nurturing.
You literally mother them. You look for their needs. They have their problems. You try to help them solve their problems. And only you can do it. If you leave them all alone, they're not going to make it. And this is coming back again, and I'm going to have even more. It has little tubers, and I put rooting hormone on some of them.
Lorraine, thanks for that. Ketzel and Tom are our two gardeners. Do you have parental feelings about your gardens, Tom?
Oh, I do. I get very possessive about some of my plants and wanting to nurture them and propagate them and cosset them.
I don't know if you're a dad. I was wondering if you look at them as your children. You know, my sort of that awkward little rose in there is just like my daughter. And
I don't have children, so it may be that I transfer lots of those feelings to my garden. That's very possible.
And a quick word from Quetzal.
Well, I tend to transfer all of my maternal instincts to dogs. Which is probably a good thing because of the ephemeral nature of plants and the fact that they do die. And I do think that probably a gardener's heart breaks a great deal with every lost plant.
So they're just they're just occasional pals. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Richard is calling from outside Buffalo, New York, I gather.
Yes, that's right, Judy. Near Buffalo, near New York, near Northeast. And I was wondering, I heard that trees communicate through chemical release. And I don't know if flowers would do the same thing, because the story was a black cherry was attacked by insects. It released a chemical, and the other trees received it and sort of prepared themselves and put some kind of toxin in their leaves to resist this insect.
Good heavens, Richard. Well, let's put that question to Chaminade Russell, the author of Anatomy of a Rose. Do they have this sort of communication and pass on
absolutely right. Trees do that, and they have done studies to show that they release volatiles and that those are in the air, and other plants pick them up and start their own defense. Flowers themselves, of course, are part of the larger plant, and I am positive that when you look in a field of wildflowers, you will know that those plants out there are communicating in a similar way. They're releasing volatiles. They're exchanging that kind of information. People don't tend to do intensive research studies on geraniums, so we don't have as much information as we do on crop trees and things like that.
You know, before the end of this program, I'm going to be convinced that plants have personalities, because in your book you talk about dirty tricks. I mean, are they vicious little beasties?
Well, they want to survive, and they'll fool insects all the time, and they'll fool their pollinators all the time. They have, you know, one thing in mind, which is to get their eggs fertilized and then to bear fruit and to come again next spring, Richard, and whatever it takes.
Richard, thanks for your call, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Elizabeth is picking up the poetic theme in South Carolina. Elizabeth.
Hi. Earlier you were talking about poems that really capture the beauty of flowers.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm wondering whether anybody's thinking about Wordsworth, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud.
Do you know it?
Yes, I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. And then I know that's probably the only line that I have memorized. I'm calling on my car phone, actually. I don't have a book with me or anything. But there's one part of the poem that talks about when oft upon my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye that is the bliss of solitude. And that's so true about how, you know, that poem is so picturesque.
And it's special about spring, is it, particularly, being daffodils?
Yeah, big daffodils, and they come back each spring. You chop them down, and then they come back, and they're beautiful. And I just thought I would share that with your listeners.
Tell me what's going on in South Carolina. You must be way ahead of us now.
Oh, South Carolina is beautiful with flowers. There are the hydrangeas, there are the azaleas. You have tons of tulips. Talk about a host of colors. Blooming trees, you have the pears and all the blossoming trees, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful place to be in spring, especially right about now, right as March is about to end. It's just so amazingly colorful.
Elizabeth, thanks very much for that. Just a quick word from Tom Fisher. You know, you, poet and gardener, why do you live here?
In lots of ways, coastal New England is not a bad place to garden. Our winters aren't enviable, I will grant you. But summer is a great time. I love the New England summers. They're not too hot. They're nice and breezy, and you can grow a lot of good perennials in this climate. And we've got a pretty good spring and autumn as well. So I would say we can't grow nearly the range of stuff that Quetzal can there in Portland. But compared with lots of other places and parts of the country, it's not bad at all.
Chaminade Russell, tell us what's going on there.
Well, we're a mountain. We're the tail end of the Rocky Mountains, and so it's temperate, but it's been kind of a cold, wet winter, which we're very grateful for. We're a very dry area. Things really have to struggle here. We get most of our wildflowers in the monsoon season in the summer. Only the hardiest plants. We have something we call DYCs. That's short for damn yellow composites. Mm. All little flowers that are everywhere. We have a lot of ranching in this area, and I think that's where the negative aspect of that comes in. So we have small, hardy wildflowers, and then we have beautiful gardens where people try to create their own kind of paradise and their own own home and their own environment.
Sharman, I can see why you can look into, latch into all the diversity of plants. But let's hear from Alice. Now, the phone number to ring, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Allison, hello.
Hello, my name is Alice.
Alice.
I am in Scituate, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I called because you were talking a little bit about houseplants. I have two very fussy houseplants that I was told don't like to be moved. They were owned by my mother-in-law initially, and she had them both for about 25 years before the first one bloomed. They're called Hoya, H-O-Y-A. The second one finally bloomed last year. When the first one bloomed, it was about a month before she died. And the flowers are like a dandelion flower when it's gone to seed, but they're all little half-inch diameter stars that look like they're velvet. Inside the white velvet, there's another little star. Inside that, there's a red star.
And are they now blooming, Alice?
As a matter of fact, they're getting ready to, again. I don't know how to figure out when they're going to bloom, except that I see the corm start to develop the little buds.
Tom Fisher, our gardening expert from Horticulture magazine. We have heard a few stories on this of how sort of there is a loss and then suddenly a flower blooms. Is there a transference of energy, or do flowers pick up our vibrations, our moods?
I think lots of plants have minds of their own. They can go along for a long, long time just sitting there sullenly and not doing a thing. And it may be that just that they're responding to increased daylight. Maybe you change your watering practices a little bit, giving it a little bit more, a little bit less water. Maybe you finally decide to give it a little fertilizer. But the plant's probably picking up on some environmental cue that finally gets it to bloom. It's nice to think that it's doing it in response to our wishes, but there's probably something else going on there as well.
I think my houseplants look at me and think, killer. Anyway, Tom Fisher, thanks very much for joining us. Tom Fisher is executive editor of Horticulture magazine, and from Portland, Oregon, my thanks to the doyen of dirt, Ketzel Levine, NPR correspondent and host of Talking Plants at NPR.org. Also, thank you to Sharman Apt Russell, author of Anatomy of a Rose, Exploring the Secret Life of Flowers, who joined us from Silver City, New Mexico. Connection listeners, you can continue the flower conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.